Tour 4, A Winter Raid. While Johnson was building Fort William Henry at one end of Lake George, the French began Fort Ticonderoga at the other, though they did not finish it till the next year. In the winter of 1757, hearing that the English were making great preparations at Fort William Henry to attack them, they resolved to anticipate the blow and seize that post by surprise. To this end, Doddridge, governor of Canada, sent a large detachment from Montreal, while the small body of troops and provincials who occupied the English fort remained wholly ignorant of the movement. In St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, the Irish soldiers who formed a part of the garrison of Fort William Henry were paying homage to their patron saint in libations of Arabic rum, the product of New England stills, and it is said that John Stark's rangers forgot geological differences in their zeal to share the festivity. The story adds that they were restrained by their commander, and that their enforced sobriety proved the saving of the fort. This may be doubted, for without counting the English soldiers of the garrison who had no special call to be drunk that day, the fort was in no danger till 24 hours after, when the revelers had had time to rally from their ice carouse. Whether rangers or British soldiers, it is certain that watchmen were on the alert during the night between the 18th and 19th, and that towards 1 in the morning they heard a sound of axes far down the lake, followed by the faint glow of a distant fire. The inference was plain, that an enemy was there, and that the necessity of warming himself had overcome his caution. Then all was still for some 2 hours, when, listening in the pitchy darkness, the watchers heard the footsteps of a great body of men approaching on the ice, which at the time was bare of snow. The garrison were at their posts, and all the cannon in the side towards the lake vomited grape and round shot in the direction of the sound, which thereafter was heard no more. Those who made it were the detachment, called by Doddridge an army, sent by him to seize the English fort. Shirley had planned a similar stroke against Ticonderoga a year before, but the provincial levies had come in so slowly, and the ice had broken up so soon, that the scheme was abandoned. Doddridge was more fortunate. The whole force, regulars, Canadians, and Indians, was ready to his hand. No pains were spared in equipping them. Overcoats, blankets, bearskins to sleep on, tarpaulins to sleep under, spare moccasins, spare mittens, kettles, axes, needles, awls, flint and steel, and many miscellaneous articles were provided, to be dragged by the men in light Indian sledges, along with provisions for 12 days. The cost of the expedition is set at 1,000,000 francs, answering to more than as many dollars of the present time. To the disgust of the officers from France, the governor named his brother Rigaud for the chief command, and before the end of February the whole party was on its march along the ice of Lake Champlain. They rested nearly a week at Ticonderoga, where no less than 300 short scaling ladders, so constructed that 2 or more could be joined in one, had been made for them, and here, too, they received a reinforcement, which raised their number to 1,600. Then, marching 3 days along Lake George, they neared the fort in the evening of the 18th, and prepared for a general assault before daybreak. The garrison, including rangers, consisted of 346 effective men. The fort was not strong, and a resolute assault by numbers so superior must, it seems, have overpowered the defenders, but the Canadians and Indians who composed most of the attacking force were not suited for such work, and, disappointed in his hope of a surprise, Rigaud withdrew them at daybreak, after trying in vain to burn the buildings outside. A few hours after, the whole body reappeared, filing off to surround the fort, in which they kept up a brisk but harmless fire of musketry. In the night they were heard again on the ice, approaching, as if for an assault, and the cannon, firing towards the sound, again drove them back. There was silence for a while, till tongues of flame lighted up the gloom, and two sloops, ice-bound in the lake, and a large number of bateaux in the shore were seen to be on fire. A party sallied to save them, but it was too late. In the morning they were all consumed, and the enemy had vanished. It was Sunday, the 20th. Everything was quiet till noon, when the French filed out of the woods and marched across the ice in procession, ostentatiously carrying their scaling ladders, and showing themselves to the best effect. They stopped at a safe distance, fronting towards the fort, and several of them advanced, waving a red flag. An officer with a few men went to meet them, and returned bringing Le Mercier, chief of the Canadian artillery, who, being led blindfold into the fort, announced himself as bearer of a message from Rigaud. He was conducted to the room of Major Eyre, where all the British officers were assembled, and, after mutual compliments, he invited them to give up the place peaceably, promising the most favorable terms, and threatening a general assault and massacre in case of refusal. Eyre said that he should defend himself to the last, and the envoy, again blindfolded, was led back to whence he came. The whole French force now advanced, as if to storm the works, and the garrison prepared to receive them. Nothing came of it but a fusillade, to which the British made no reply. At night the French were heard advancing again, and each man nerved himself for the crisis. The real attack, however, was not against the fort, but against the buildings outside, which consisted of several storehouses, a hospital, a sawmill, and the huts of the rangers, besides a sloop in the stocks and piles of planks and cordwood. Covered by the night, the assailants crept up with agates of resinous sticks, placed them against the farther side of the buildings, kindled them, and escaped before the flame rose, while the garrison, straining their ears in the thick darkness, fired, wherever they heard a sound. Before morning all around them was in a blaze, and they had much ado to save the fort barracks from the shower of burning cinders. At 10 o'clock the fires had subsided, and a thick fall of snow began, filling the air with a restless chaos of large moist flakes. This lasted all day and all the next night, till the ground and the ice were covered to a depth of 3 feet and more. The French lay close in their camps till a little before dawn in Tuesday morning, when 20 volunteers from the regulars made a bold attempt to burn the sloop in the stocks, with several storehouses and other structures, and several hundred scows and whaleboats which had thus far escaped. They were only in part successful, but they fired the sloop and some buildings near it, and stood far out in the ice watching the flaming vessel, a superb bonfire amid the wilderness of snow. The spectacle cost the volunteers a fourth of their number killed and wounded. In Wednesday morning the sun rose bright in a scene of wintry splendor, and the frozen lake was dotted with Rigaud's retreating followers toiling towards Canada on snowshoes. Before they reached it many of them were blinded for a while by the insufferable glare, and their comrades led them homewards by the hand.